Evening, everybody. Good to see you all. Missed you last week. And I guess now it's dark here in California. Probably if you're east of here, it's darker still. And thanks very, very much to James, who gave a particularly wonderful talk last week, I thought, on chapters 2 and 3 of Dhammapada. I really enjoyed his talk. And in the talk, he reminded us, and reminded me, because I had completely forgotten about this, that for years, we would give homework every week at the seminar. And that was a really great idea. And I don't remember when we stopped doing that or why we stopped doing that. But I think that he started it again, and I think it's a good idea. So I want to continue with that. So before I say anything today, I'll start with the homework from last time and see if there's anybody who has anything to say about the assignment that James gave us all, which, if I have it correctly, was something like this. Notice those moments when you are suddenly free from your usual conditioning, when you are able to enjoy the freedom of your practice. So he asked all of us to pay attention to those moments during the week and see what happens. So if there's anybody at all who has something to say about that, raise your hand and Shufi will call on you and you can make some comment. I'll leave space for that for a moment.
Patricia. Well, I found it arising during Zazen and the rest of the time, not so much. But I was happy that it occurred during Zazen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can, my mind can wander a lot during Zazen, and it helped me. Really, the feeling of great spaciousness and peaceful quiet and settledness was quite wonderful during Zazen. So, start.
Yeah, well, actually, that's pretty great, because I think there's a lot of people who would say, I never experience any sense of spaciousness or freedom, ever. 24 hours a day, never. Maybe when I'm asleep. I think a lot of people would say that. So it's a blessing. It's a blessing that you have moments like that in Zazen, yeah.
Yes. So I appreciated the homework.
Yeah.
Alor.
I had a strange moment the other day, a few seconds after Zazen, a few minutes, I was changing into my exercise clothes and I realized I was missing a sock. Now, my closet where they were, the other sock was not very far, but what I noticed is how easily I took fright just for a little sock. And this business of taking fright is really something that is part of me. And that's what I realized. I really got why? Taking fright for a sock that's missing. Okay. That was my little thing.
James.
Good afternoon. Good evening. In Everyday Caring, we had an incredible conversation that I feel aligns with this paying attention. someone was reporting that they had a health incident and were feeling really bad, that their children weren't checking in, calling, and asking how they were doing. And she reported about having this experience that what was happening was she was craving something that wasn't there.
Mm.
So she was creating her own sense of suffering. And that kind of, you know, don't take what isn't given, don't, you know, that precept, she kind of attached that experience to that precept.
Mm.
and flipped it around to become aware of the things that had happened well with this health incident, and rather than looking for what didn't happen or what didn't work or what she wanted and was missing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful kind of just self-realization, and it's carried me through this week to just be aware when the precepts show up in our lives, you know, just show up. And, you know, not that we're marching doggedly to them, but we're aware of them when they're present.
Mm. So, great. Thank you.
I'm very moved.
So thank you, yeah. We have two more, and then we'll go on.
Great. So I had many moments where I was in some state of freedom, but I was noticing without noticing it at the time.
Mm.
It was okay. It was normal. It was, I don't know what to say, mm-hmm. more than mm-hmm. that it was free.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I had these other experiences where I've got these two new cats who are driving me slightly crazy. And I was getting angry at them about various things. And I realized in the middle of all that, that I wasn't very invested in myself at mm. all mm. in that, other than to take note of the fact that there were things I could do better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say about all this, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it is true that if you put a label on, oh, an experience of freedom, then it's not really an experience of freedom anymore. It's something else, yeah.
Well, I actually kind of the opposite route. I notice when I'm not free of my conditioning, usually like when I'm driving, something like that, and I'll get in that state. And I have a key to taking care of that, which is I always look for the first tree I see. And somehow, trees and I just, all of a sudden, I'm back in the free space that I need to be in.
Mm. That's great. Yeah, I like trees a lot, too. Trees are profound, yeah. Well, thanks for all that. Yeah, it's good to have a little homework, right? And to bring these teachings down to the ordinary everyday, which is what they're supposed to be about in the end, aren't they? So, okay, let's go on. I'm going to do some words about the next chapter, which is chapter 4, about flowers. Flowers. And I'm using here, I'm going to quote all the verses, and I'll quote them in Tanisaro's translation. Who will penetrate this earth and this realm of death with all its gods? Who will ferret out the well-taught Dhamma saying as the skillful flower arranger, the flower? The learner on the path will penetrate this earth and this realm of death with all its gods. The learner on the path will ferret out well-taught Dhamma saying as the skillful flower arranger, the flower. So the whole chapter is an extended metaphor about flowers. And flowers are very beautiful, delicate, fragrant. And so for that alone, we love them and they're valuable, as beauty is somehow both useless, non-productive, and at the same time really, really valuable. But also, flowers are productive too. They turn into fruit, they feed bees and butterflies and so on, and they're useful then as well as beautiful. And of course, the main thing about them is they're so achingly impermanent. You know, the fresh life of a flower is days long. And they fade rather quickly, mostly. And somehow this makes them even more precious to us. So this is a good metaphor to use for this chapter. Flowers are a good metaphor for life and for our human experience. And the opening stanza here, who will penetrate this earth in this realm of death? Who will ferret out the well-taught Dharma saying? Brings up a really important thought. Thanissaro uses the word penetrate, who will penetrate, but others translate conquer or master. And what it's saying is that through the Dharma, we can really understand this world, this life, through and through. And we can live it without fear. And we can live it with a sense of mastery or craft, as if life itself is something we are really doing carefully. So it's not a matter of controlling or dominating, but with a confidence that we understand our life and that we can be ready and equal to anything in our life, anything in the world. But it's not only the earth that can be penetrated, but also just as importantly, and these things seem to go together, death with all its gods and its terrors. Who can penetrate the earth and see through death? So that death becomes a companion and a friend rather than an adversary. Impermanence is our friend, not our enemy. Who can do that? The one who practices can do that. The one who is on the path and the one who's paying attention, who's learning more and ripening in their practice every day. And how do you do this? By knowing how to turn the Dharma so that you can find the appropriate teaching, the appropriate response to the moment that you're living, whether it's a moment of life or a moment of death. Somebody once asked Yunmun, what's the teaching of a lifetime? And Yunmun said, an appropriate response. So here in the text it says, who can ferret out a wise Dharma saying for the occasion? But maybe it's less a matter of ferreting out a saying than it is of knowing in the moment how to be in that moment, how to live, how to let go of our attachment, the way Jeff lets go of his attachment by looking at a tree. That's his appropriate response in that moment. So in other words, it's not necessarily that we have to ponder and think about it, because we internalize the teachings through our investigation and through our conduct every day and through our ongoing practice. And so it becomes, little by little, you know, as we kind of notice it sometimes, and sometimes we don't even notice how little by little the teachings are becoming quite natural to us. It becomes the way that we respond. And so it's wonderful to think that we become the flower arrangers for our lifetime. We know how to pick out just the right flower in that moment to put in the arrangement of our life. So the bouquet of our life today is more beautiful. Verse 46, knowing this body is like foam, realizing its nature, a mirage, cutting out the blossoms of Mara, you go where the king of death can't see. It's kind of funny because when you think about it, a system of thought like Buddhism that assumes rebirth, you would think that death would not be such a big deal, you know. it would not be such a great cause for dread, since you're going to be reborn. You know, what's the big worry about death? You know, you're just going to come back to life. But actually, the people who understand it that way have the opposite idea. Instead of thinking because you're reborn, you don't have to stress out so much about death, actually you stress out even more. Because if death is a horrible trauma, if there's only one life, then you get it over with and it's done. But if you're born again and again and again, you have to go through that trauma over and over and over again. So it's really terrible. So defeating death, ending death once and for all, is the goal. It's what we want to do. What we call death implies that there must be something real and substantial that experiences this trauma. There must be some real and substantial great loss. But that's the fallacy. The sage is the one who knows that this is not actually the case, as difficult as our losses may be. The sage is the one who knows that life is like a bubble of foam on the beach, that the wind quickly blows across the beach and apart, that life is a mirage, a dream, a fantasy, a lamp, a lantern, like the Diamond Sutra says. So death is not the trauma that it appears to be. And to know this is to cut the flower of Mara the tempter, who doesn't want us to awaken. Mara is constantly scheming to keep us confused and bound to this life as we understand it. And one of the things that Mara uses to do this to us is to entice us with beautiful flowers. But when we know how things really are, we can cut those flowers of Mara and we can put them in a vase on our table and we can enjoy them without falling into Mara's clutches. And when we know how things really are, we cannot be snatched up by death, because death won't be able to find us, because we won't be there. This reminds me of some stories that Dogen tells in Continuous Practice about some monks who were hermits in the mountains and were fed by the gods. But after they began continuous practice, the gods couldn't find them anymore. And so the gods couldn't feed them anymore. And counterintuitive though it is, this is the often stated goal, you know, of our practice: to become invisible, to become traceless. Not in the obvious and conventional sense, you know, that we should be shy or retiring people who never speak up or act up or bother anybody, not like that. But in the more profound sense, that we would want to live and die and act and speak with an engagement that is so full in the moment that there's nothing left out and no remainder. The whole moment is complete. We're just completely here and then on to the next moment with no trace. Verses 47 and 48. The man immersed in gathering blossoms, or the person immersed in gathering blossoms, their heart distracted, death sweeps them away as a great flood, a village asleep. The person immersed in gathering blossoms, their heart distracted, insatiable in sensual pleasures, the end maker holds them under his sway. The end maker being Yama, the god of death. And in these verses, the metaphor of flowers is used to evoke our attachment to pleasure and beauty. Although it might not seem like this, sometimes in the teachings, you know, there's a kind of disgust almost at beauty and pleasure. But in fact, what the teachings are trying to tell us is there's nothing at all wrong with beauty and pleasure. That these are wonderful human possibilities, and in a way, our practice frees us to truly enjoy them. The problem is getting caught up in them, which is so easy to do, because Mara is always there, right? Tempting us to do that. And before you know it, we are greedy and obsessed, dependent on these things, miserable when we don't have them. So that which we most value and which is most wonderful about being alive becomes a curse, becomes a source of misery. And even worse than that, when we're in that condition, we're going to hurt others. Because we become so obsessed with our need for pleasure and satisfaction that we don't even know there are any others. All we're trying to do is satisfy our need, and we're going to trash others in the process. So that means, in effect, that to be attached, to be bound in that way to this world, that's what it means to be subject to death and to misery. And when we're like that, death is really scary, really, really scary, because it's going to sweep us away in the end, and we will not be ready for it. And we will be in a panic, and it will be a real catastrophe. Just like a village that's peacefully asleep, not knowing something's going to happen, and all of a sudden a big flash flood comes and wipes it out. An experience that I'm sure was happening a lot in Buddha's time in India. Maybe it still happens there, I don't know. But I know that it happened in Texas this past summer, right? That's exactly what happened. A big flash flood came and wiped out a whole bunch of people. As a bee, without harming the blossom, its color, its fragrance, takes its nectar and flies away, so should the sage go through a village. I can see, you know, bees in our garden, and sometimes I watch them going along, and I think to myself, who appreciates these flowers more, me or the bee? You know, I look at the flower and I think about it, and I think, oh, how beautiful. And you know, I'm aware of a whole tradition that we have of thinking about flowers, which are symbolic. They're ideas to us, just like the flowers are an idea here in the Dhammapada. And, you know, there are so many poems you can read about flowers. Saxifrage, that flower that William Carlos Williams writes about, and so many other poems. So, in my mind, you know, all that, I got all that with the flowers. But the bee doesn't have any of that, but the bee, like, is right in the middle of the flower. I can't go into that flower. The bee goes into that flower and probably loses itself completely. Imagine being a bee surrounded by the flower and the scent of the flower. And the bee is literally receiving sustenance from the flower. It lives by the flower. And yet, in doing this, it's not hurting the flower, but instead is pollinating it. It's doing it good, right? According to this verse, the bee doesn't conceptualize the flower and become attached to that conceptualization the way we might. The bee is always moving along from flower to flower, fully immersed, fully enjoying. We can imagine each and every flower. But then, very quickly, you know, without much deliberation, the bee's on to the next flower, not lingering, not regretting, moving on. And so that's a great metaphor for us. Let's live like that. As I was saying a moment ago, you know, fully immersed, fully appreciative, and then ready for the next. Not lingering, not regretting, not stuck on anything. Next verse, number 50. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have and haven't done yourself. In a way, this verse is a little bit out of left field because there's no flower in it, you know. It's not keeping along with the concept here. And it's a verse about a very specific ethical practice that seems to be just plopped in here in this extended conversation about flowers. Why is it there? Well, we can speculate. Does it have anything to do with any of this? Well, maybe it's somehow, I'm making this up, somehow connected to the bee in the last stanza. Maybe this is how the bee practices. You can imagine a bee would practice like this, wouldn't it? So that it would be able to move on without being stuck. Anyway, this is a very clear practice, and it's a radical practice. I bet some of you have heard me mention it before, because to me it's one of the greatest of all practices that you never would think of this exactly, you know? And I myself always try to practice this all the time, and it's a great thing. The sixth ancestor had a brilliant way of putting it, and this is how it is in my mind, is the sixth ancestor's way, when he says in the Platform Sutra, I see and I don't see. So that's my practice. I see and I don't see. And somebody says, what do you mean you see and you don't see? And he says, I see my own faults, but I do not see the faults of others. In a world of constant fault finding, this is really a radical practice. And there is no better practice, really and truly, for peace of mind and harmonious human relationships. To be aware of your own shortcomings and try your best to address them, even if you aren't that successful, but not to pay much attention or any attention at all to the faults of others. Now, of course, others have faults, and sometimes their faults have an impact on us. Just the same way we have faults, and our faults have an impact on others. But their faults are their business, not ours. Those other people do not need us. I'm telling you this from experience. Those other people do not need us to point out their faults to them. They don't need us to do that. They can figure it out for themselves. And if they can't figure it out for themselves, and if they don't figure it out for themselves, there is no doubt whatsoever that our pointing out those faults to them will not help them anyway. It will only cause them to be defensive and dig in even deeper and probably get mad at us. So that's not worth doing. Because you know what? Other people are always doing their best, given their situation at the moment. Everybody is always doing their best, given their situation at the moment. People would not do what they are doing if they didn't think it was the best they could do according to their views and their current values or lack of values in that moment. People don't you look at somebody and you say, that was stupid, and you tell them how stupid it was. They surely didn't think it was stupid when they did it, or they wouldn't have done it. So we look at people and we say, well, this is what they did. This is what they do. This is what makes sense to them. Maybe we wouldn't do it that way. Maybe we don't do it that way. But that's the way they did it. And now the world is the way it is now. So we're always looking at our own conduct, always trying to do better, and not worrying at all about the conduct of others, not evaluating and passing judgment on it. Whatever we are feeling and doing is our responsibility. Other people are never to blame. Somebody else is not to be blamed if I'm hurt or angry or vengeful or upset. That's the way we maintain our own power and dignity. Nobody but me is the owner of my life, and nobody but you is the owner of your life. No other person or persons, no matter how powerful, can make you or me become what we will not become. It's always up to us. Verses 51 and 52. Just like a blossom, bright colored but scentless, a well-spoken word is fruitless when not carried out. Just like a blossom brightly colored and full of scent, a well-spoken word is fruitful when well carried out. Some flowers don't have a scent, right? The ones that have a scent are very famous for that. But maybe most flowers don't have a scent. I don't know. I guess they don't need to have a scent. And there's nothing wrong with not having a scent, but in this stanza's metaphor, the scent is very important. It means that the flower is fully alive and effective and will give way to fruit so that the life of the plant will go on. Maybe somebody here is a biologist who knows whether flowers without scent don't produce fruit. But anyway, they don't produce fruit in this stanza if they don't have a scent. A flower with a scent, with fruiting, is compared to a person who, as we like to say, walks the walk, doesn't just talk the talk. A person who has real conviction in what they say. And you can't have real conviction, real conviction, unless you do what you say and you stand by your word and really mean what you say in a way bigger than your own self-advantage. And somehow I think we all can tell when someone is just talking and just manipulating in their words and not trying to mean, not really meaning what they're saying. Sometimes people talk like that and they themselves don't know it. But we can always tell. So we should pay attention to our speech and try to say what's really, really real for us, what's really true for us, what we really live by, not just our ideas. And there's a kind of sincerity in that. I always think that that's what Suzuki Roshi means when he talks about sincerity. That we live what we say and what we are. And we value sincerity so much in our practice. And this is the way to be fruitful. This is the way that leads to more life, that leads to goodness in the future. Just as from a heap of flowers many garland strands can be made, even so one born and mortal should do with what's born and mortal many a skillful thing. So, as you all probably know, that in Buddhism the word skillful really means good, something that is supportive, peaceful, kind, that leads to a peace and happiness and away from suffering and attachment. That's what skillful means. Conduct that brings love and ends suffering. It's a wonderful metaphor comparing human conduct to a big mass of flowers from which many bouquets can be made. It's kind of delightful to think that our conduct, our speech, the way we are, can be like a big bouquet of flowers. And that can bring, you know, beauty and peace to the room, beauty and peace to the world, just by the way we speak and conduct ourselves. No flower's scent goes against the wind, not sandalwood, jasmine, tagada, but the scent of the good does go against the wind. A person of integrity wafts a scent in every direction. is a little funny at first, because usually when we think of people as being smelly, that's not a good thing. Right? We think, oh my God, that's not good. They don't smell good. I don't have too great a sense of smell, and I don't really know how people smell unless, you know, they just went on a 10-mile run and they're all sweaty, then I can tell how they smell. But mostly I can't tell how people smell. Maybe some of you have a really good sense of smell, and you can smell a pleasant, sweet-smelling person apart from their perfume or whatever kind of product they have on. Maybe you can smell them. But anyway, I think this is a metaphor, after all, and it means influence. A flower's fragrance is subject to the wind. The wind blows the fragrance and it's gone, right? It can blow it toward you, then you smell it. It can blow it away from you, then you can't smell it at all and can dissipate it altogether. But the fragrance, the influence of a person of integrity isn't blown around by the wind. It flows freely everywhere and nothing can ever blow it away. And when I was thinking about this, I remembered that our friend Charlotte Selver, who gave us the gift of the house we live in, she had a house in Nantucket Island off the coast of Maine. And she had the name of her house was Influence. She had a big plaque on the house, Influence. She would always talk about influence. Not in the sense of money and power, but in the sense of our conduct, just like the verse here is talking. And I'm a great believer in this. This is my hope, you know, for the world and for our practice. And I really know that a person who has real integrity and who's unself-conscious about this, but really lives it, you know, who does good, is genuinely kind, genuinely loves others, never vindictive or blaming, but always loving and supportive, and has the courage, the natural, easygoing courage, to always simply do the right thing in large ways and in small ways. I think that there is a tremendous and subtle effect on whatever community such a person belongs to. A subtle and effective, very positive effect. Now, in the world of workshops and trainings, when I was last aware of it a few years ago, all the workshops and trainings were about leadership. Leadership was the great buzzword. Everything got expressed in terms of leadership. Some of you who might do workshops or lead workshops, maybe you remember that. But this is not about leadership. This is way beyond leadership. It's much more subtle. It has nothing to do with position or influence in the ordinary sense, nothing to do with a direct kind of influence, but a more subtle and indirect influence. And by the way, in case you were wondering, Mr. Google says that the Tagara flower is a white flower used as a sleep medication in Ayurvedic medicine. So I never heard of that as a sleep medication. I might get some of that and see if it helps with sleep. Next verse. Sandalwood, Tagara, lotus and jasmine. Among these scents, the scent of virtue is unsurpassed. Next to nothing, this fragrance, sandalwood, Tagara, while the scent of the virtuous wafts to the god, to the gods supreme. And now it occurs to me that so many expressions in the Gandavyuha Sutra that we were reading. Remember that a long time ago when we were immersed in the Gandavyuha Sutra? It's all gone now. I can't remember a word of it. But I do remember that there were lots of expressions about fragrance. Remember that? One of the things that was appearing quite a bit was the beautiful fragrances that came from the virtuous conduct and the good hearts of the bodhisattvas. Those consummate in virtue, dwelling in heedfulness, released through right knowing, Mara can't follow their tracks. And this repeats the thought of several verses earlier that while the subtle influence of a person of integrity is always pervasive and long-lasting, the person themselves is at the same time absolutely invisible to Mara. Mara can't do anything to this person who cannot be tempted to behave in a selfish way, who cannot be knocked over by the forces of corruption and confusion, because they know better. So they're not tempted at all. Here, three aspects of the sage or the person who walks the path are given. First, embrace of virtue or beautiful ethical conduct. Second, heedfulness, which I think is Tanisaro's translation of apramada, which means diligence, you know, making sincere effort all the time for the good, paying attention all the time. And third, right knowing or right understanding. That is, knowing things as they really are, which is not something that you know kind of as an object, but a kind of feeling for living or a vision for living. I'm looking at also, when I'm studying the Dhammapada, I'm looking at a number of translations, and one of the virtues of Thomas Cleary's translation is that once in a while he'll add some Zen sayings as commentaries to the text, because he's such an expert on Zen literature. And for this verse, he quotes Linji, who says, "People who study Buddhism should seek true perception and understanding. If you attain true perception and understanding, birth and death don't affect you. You are free to go or stay." And here's the final verse of the chapter. "As in a pile of rubbish cast by the side of a highway, a lotus might grow, clean smelling, pleasing the heart, so in the midst of the rubbish-like people, run-of-the-mill and blind, there dazzles with discernment the disciple of the rightly self-awakened one," meaning, of course, a disciple of the Buddha. As we probably said in the beginning, and I think James also said this last week, the Dhammapada is a text that is meant to be poetic and clear and straightforward. It is making a distinct argument for the virtue and necessity of practice. And so it is interested in drawing a very clear distinction between a sage, on the one hand, and the so-called foolish common people, on the other hand. And, you know, by our contemporary standards, that might seem a little offensive to us to think of the foolish common people, especially because we are the foolish common people, and it's insulting, right? And we don't like that. But, of course, the Dhammapada here is not interested in being disrespectful. That's not the point. It's, as I say, trying to show us, to persuade us in the clearest way that it knows how, that we can become as noble, as wise as it's possible for a human being to be. We can do that. And anybody can do that. Even the foolish common people like us can do that if we devote ourselves to the path. And maybe we don't think of foolish common people or the world to be like a pile of rubbish by the side of the road. Maybe we think of human beings as wonderful and the world as lovely. So maybe this final metaphor is a little offensive, but you get the point. And, you know, for sure, we can look around at the world and see, especially I'm talking about the human world, it can be very ugly, right? The human world, it can be pretty corrupt and difficult and nasty. People can be very twisted. We're noticing this. Twisted by resentment, anger, fear, and blame. Yeah, a bit like a pile of garbage. So the idea that this corrupt and difficult world, as it is right now, without anybody fixing it, can grow a lotus flower. Right out of the middle of this crappy stuff, a lotus flower that's very beautiful and fragrant and pleasing, dazzlingly gorgeous, even more gorgeous, exactly because it grows out of this kind of ground. So, thank you for listening. And now let's have groups for discussion. We'll have groups of three as we always do, and we'll have 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes with a little time extra. I think we have time for all that. And the topic that I'm suggesting, although as always you can take any topic that's important for you, is specifically that one stanza that I pointed out is sort of anomalous in the chapter about the practice of the sixth ancestor. I see and I don't see. I see my own faults, I don't see the faults of others. Let's talk about that. What do you think of it? Have you heard about it? Do you practice it? How does it strike you? And for those of you who might not be able to stay for the groups, that's also the homework, to try to practice that between now and the next time. And the next time, in fact, is a while from now, because next Wednesday is the night before Thanksgiving, and you're all going to be busily working in your kitchens making amazing food for the next day. So we never meet on the Wednesday before the Thursday of Thanksgiving, so we won't meet next week. And when we meet the week after that, that's when Kathy and I are going to be in Mexico with our Sangha down there doing Sesshin. So Christopher is going to be giving the Dharma talk on the next chapters that week. And maybe Christopher will remember the homework. So this is a two-week homework. It's a good one for 2 weeks, right? Look at this one. Maybe in 2 weeks you'll either like think it's an absurd thing to try to do this, or you will have like perfected it by the time Christopher, if he remembers, asks you about it. So anyway, Shufi, please put everybody in their groups, and I'll see you again in about, 12 or 13 or 15, whatever, minutes. Have fun in the groups. Enjoy it. See you soon.
Recording stopped.